Hey everyone, my name is Michael Arndt. I'm a screenwriter. I helped to write the screenplay for Toy Story 3, and I worked on that script from 2006 to 2009, and those 3 years were just a complete nightmare of anxiety and confusion and just stumbling around in the dark and total creative agony. We just beat our head against the floor for like 3 years trying to get that story to work, and it was just horrible. So after the film came out, I just thought, like, no one should ever have to suffer like that again. So when I left Pixar in 2011, I put together this lecture about all the mistakes we made while writing Toy Story 3 and lessons we learned trying to overcome those mistakes. So now I've taken that lecture and turned it into this video. And my hope is that if you're writing a screenplay yourself and you're going down blind alleys and walking into brick walls and just beating your head against the floor, maybe some of these lessons will be helpful. Now, I just want to add a quick disclaimer, because I know I'm going to get roasted alive by people who will say that I'm trying to turn storytelling into a formula. So very briefly, like, this is not the only way to tell a story, okay? You can tell a story any way you want. This is just a process that we went through and lessons that I learned while writing Toy Story 3, and I'm just hoping that they can be tools and not rules for anyone who is struggling with their own scripts. So I hope this is helpful. End of disclaimer. Okay, so before I go any further, I have to step back and explain how scripts get written at Pixar. Now, as you may have heard, it's a highly, highly collaborative process. So even though I was credited as the screenwriter on Toy Story 3, the truth is there was like this whole team of people, writers and story artists, that helped put the story together. So with all the help I had, in all honesty, like, they could have hired a drunken chimpanzee to write the script and it still would have turned out pretty well. So what happens at Pixar is step one is you write the script and you do a couple of drafts just to get the basics of the story into place. But then pretty quickly, step two is that script gets turned into what's called a set of reels, which is a very rough version of the movie using hand-drawn sketches and temp music and temp dialogue. And when the first set of reels is finished, step three is you go into the main theater at Pixar and you screen it for the so-called brain trust of Pixar writers and directors. So when I was there, the brain trust was Darla Anderson, Brad Bird, Brenda Chapman, Pete Docter, John Lasseter, Bob Peterson, Jeff Pigeon, Gary Rydstrom, Andrew Stanton, and Lee Unkrich, and last but not least, Ed Catmull, the founder of Pixar. So you screen your reels for the brain trust, and then you go into a conference room called West Side One, and you have your story meeting, step four. And for me, those story meetings were just incredibly great because at their best, they're like this total creative free-for-all where like everybody is helping you out and some of the smartest storytellers on the planet are just sitting around and telling you how to make your story better. And the key thing here is that no one is forcing you to change your story. Like, everyone is just offering up their best ideas, and it's kind of up to the director to pick and choose which ideas he or she wants to use. So you have your story meeting, and you get all these ideas about what's working in your story, what's not working, and then you have to go back to your office and write a new draft. And then the artists and the editors turn that new draft into a new set of reels, and the process repeats itself. You do a draft, reels, meeting, draft, reels, meeting. So the stories at Pixar are like cathedrals. They're really the expression of a whole community rather than just a single individual. Okay, so with Toy Story 3, we made 7 sets of reels, which means we basically made the entire film from start to finish 7 times before it went to final animation. And if you'll allow me to get up on my soapbox for 60 seconds, this is just a great, great way of making movies, because what it allows you to do is to beta test your story on the big screen in front of a real audience. So you don't have to rely on the notes of a handful of studio executives, right? You can just show the movie itself in a rough form and let an audience tell you what is working and what is not. So it's like software. You do version 1.0 and then you debug it. You do version 2.0, you debug it. And you just keep iterating your story until it works and you reach golden master status. Now, obviously, all films should not be made this way. You wouldn't make a Wong Kar-wai movie or a Terrence Malick movie this way. But I'm telling you, man, if you're trying to make a comedy or just a film for a general audience, the reels process is just an incredible tool for writing and refining your story. So the real hero of this video is not me, the hapless and blundering screenwriter, or even the Pixar Brain Trust. The real hero is the process itself, which is iterative, collaborative, and director-driven. But don't take it from me. Here's Steve Jobs and John Lasseter describing the reels process back in 1995.
Makes it so that we can look at those still drawings with scratch dialogue, scratch music, sit back, watch it on a big projection video, and that film will tell us if it's working or not. If it's working in our story reels, when we animate it and put the colors to it, it's going to work even better. If it's not working in the story reels, the animation won't save it.
In essence, it lets us beta test and iterate our film before we make it. Totally different than live action filmmaking. And we believe it's one of the reasons that the hit rate can be substantially different.
In essence, it lets us beta test and iterate our film before making it. Like, that is the heart of the Pixar method, and there's no reason why live-action films can't use the same process to refine and optimize their own stories. And if you want to learn more about this, you should buy Ed Catmull's book called Creativity Inc., because he's about 1,000 times smarter than me about all this stuff. So, end of soapbox rant. Let's go back to Toy Story 3. So when I got hired to write Toy Story 3 in 2006, no one at Pixar really had any idea what the story was going to be. And what happened was that the creative principals on the first two Toy Story movies went off and had a two-day retreat. And this was Darla Anderson, Pete Docter, John Lasseter, Bob Peterson, Jeff Pidgeon, Andrew Stanton, and Lee Unkrich. And for 2 days, they just kind of sat around and threw out a bunch of ideas. And eventually, they came up with the foundation of a story. And so they came back to Pixar, and Andrew Stanton wrote up a 20-page treatment, and that's what got handed to me. And what that treatment had from the very start was just this rock-solid beginning, which was the idea that Andy had grown up, and the toys were now facing this uncertain future. And then the toys decide to donate themselves to a daycare center, which initially seems great, but then they realize that it's not so great and they need to escape from it. And then the last thing they had, and this was crucial, they came up with this great ending, which was that Andy was going to give all his toys away to a little girl named Bonnie. So that's what we started with. And it was pretty basic, but the foundations were just rock solid. So I went off for about 2 months and I wrote up a first draft. And pretty quickly, that script got turned into the first set of reels. And the thing about first drafts is that they're always heartbreaking because you do the best job you can. Like, you go to the end of your abilities, you put everything into it, and you just want the world to love your first draft as much as you love it. But spoiler alert, right? Most first drafts just don't work at all, and Toy Story 3 was no exception. So the challenge in writing, right, is to how to go from your terrible first draft to a finished film. So that's what this video is about, is trying to get from your clumsy first draft to a finished story that really works. Okay, so what I'm going to do is break down the script to Toy Story 3 into 6 tentpole moments. And you'll see that even though we thought we knew how good stories worked, right, and we did our best when we put them together, these scenes from that first set of reels, they just didn't work as well as they should have. And then I'll talk about how we screened those badly written scenes for the Brain Trust and the feedback we got from them. And then I'll play the clips from the finished film, and you'll be able to see how we went from a clumsy first draft to the finished film. And this is something Pixar's never really done before, showing unfinished reels. And I just have to say that I'm incredibly grateful to Pixar for everything I learned while I was working there. And I hope they won't mind me using these clips so that other people can learn from them as well. So thank you, thank you, thank you to Pixar. So let's begin at the beginning, the mistakes we made and the lessons we learned in putting together the story's opening. So when I started writing Toy Story 3, I'd already written a bunch of screenplays, including Little Miss Sunshine, and I thought I had a pretty good sense of the basics of storytelling. So, for example, I thought I knew how an opening worked. Like, obviously, with an opening, you're establishing your characters and your setting. But you're also establishing the relationships between those characters. You're establishing the backstory of what's happened to those characters in the past. And you're also setting up your characters' expectations for the future. Now, because there'd already been two other Toy Story films, the first three things were pretty much taken care of. Like, we knew the characters, we knew the setting, we knew their relationships. And it was even pretty easy to figure out what the backstory should be. Obviously, the toys have been sitting in the toy chest for 10 years and they haven't been played with. And I know this sounds crazy, but like one of the most difficult things we went through in Toy Story 3 was just figuring out like what the toys' expectations for the future should be. So when the film starts, you're going to meet these characters, and right away you establish that Andy's grown up, Andy's going away to college. But then you have to tell your audience, okay, Andy's going to college. What do these characters think is going to happen next? And it just seems completely obvious in retrospect, but it took us like a long, long time to figure out what was the best way to reintroduce these characters and especially to tell the audience what were their expectations for the future. So when you break it down, there's actually not too many things that can happen to a toy when their child grows up, right? They can be taken to college, and that's sort of the best case scenario. They can get put up in the attic, which is sort of okay, but not so great. Then Andy could also hand his toys off to his little sister, Molly, and then worst case scenario, they could all just get thrown away. And then the last alternative is that Andy could give his toy away to another child, but that was going to be the actual end of our movie, so we wanted to do everything we could to hide that possibility so it would be a surprise at the end. So you really just have four possibilities, which are college, attic, Molly, and garbage. Okay, so when I sat down to write the first draft, my first thought was, like, wouldn't it be smart to give each character a different idea of what was going to happen to them, and that way you could lay out all the possibilities for the audience. So I thought, well, you know, maybe, like, Buzz is the can-do All-American hero, and he's optimistic enough to think that Andy's going to take them all to college, right? And I thought, well, you know, Mr. Potato Head, obviously, he's the cynic of the group, and maybe he thinks they're all just going to get thrown out. And then I thought, well, the other toys, maybe they're not so sure, they're going to get put up in the attic, or they just don't know what's going to happen. And then I thought, well, maybe Woody is smart enough to say, well, guys, like, I don't know what's going to happen, but this is Andy we're talking about. He's always done right by us in the past. So that was my first idea. So I sat down, I wrote the opening scene in which you meet all the characters and they all get together and they discuss what their expectations for the future are. And of course, with every first draft, like, you do your best, right? You try your hardest, you go to the end of your abilities, and you're hoping that people are going to like it. And then inevitably, it doesn't quite work out that way. So this is showing early work in public, which is just super embarrassing. But here it comes, the opening from the very first story reel of Toy Story 3.
Oh, here it is. So, listen, they have this party for incoming freshmen. Yeah, the whole freshman.
Oh, we have an excellent chance of being played with today.
He touched me. He actually touched me.
Oh, this is just sad.
Guys, come on. What do we always say? It's not about how much playtime we get.
It's about being there for Andy.
Well, what about Andy being there for us?
We just want to play with toys.
You really think Andy's going to take us all to college with him?
Of course he will. Absolutely.
And even if he doesn't, we still have Molly to play with till Andy gets back, right? Huh? Okay, so Molly's not ideal.
Not ideal? Just take me to the junkyard and get it over with.
Why don't we just admit it? We're a bunch of outdated, over-the-hill has-beens. No one's ever gonna play with us.
All right. Now listen to me, everyone. We may not be the latest and greatest. We're not digitized, computerized, whateverized. But darn it, we're toys. We were put on this earth for one reason. To make a child happy. And we could still do that. Now, I don't know what Andy's going to do with us, but he's never let us down before. We're his toys. We got to trust him.
Incoming! Andy and Molly on the stairs! 5 seconds! Let's move!
Okay, so obviously it's not great, but it was just our first attempt, and we knew it wasn't perfect, but we were trying to lay out clearly the toys' expectations for the future, and we thought we had done everything an opening needed to do. So we finished these story reels, we bring them into the main theater, we screen them for the Brain Trust. And at the end, the lights come up, and there's just this tepid, like, half-hearted applause, and everyone gets up and walks out of the theater in silence, and, like, no one is making eye contact with me. It's just a total nightmare. So we go up to West Side 1, and we have a story meeting, and the verdict from the Brain Trust is, this is just a bunch of people standing around talking, which is a problem because it's boring and it's non-cinematic. And it really didn't take long to figure out that my initial instinct was just completely wrong, and this is what's going to happen when you give everyone a different set of expectations. Everyone's just going to sit around and argue with each other. So how do you fix this, right? How do you set up your characters' expectations without it being a bunch of people just standing around talking? And the answer was just obvious in retrospect, was that the toys have already had this conversation a million times. They've all decided that they're going to go up into the attic. And to them, this is just a reasonable set of expectations, right? It's too optimistic to think that they're all going to go to college with Andy, and it's too pessimistic to think that Andy's going to throw them all away. So when you meet them, right off the bat, you have to have Woody say something like, guys, we've talked about this a million times, and you establish that the toys have a sort of handshake deal with Andy, right? They just expect that if you're a toy and you put in 20 years of service to your kid, like instead of getting a gold watch for retirement, you get retired to the attic. And what's great about giving all those toys a single set of expectations is that then those expectations can get disrupted when your inciting incident comes along. So Woody thought he was going to the attic, but then suddenly he gets put in the college box. And for him, that's like the best possible thing. But the other toys, they thought they were going to the attic, and now they're getting put into a garbage bag and put on the curb. And for them, that's like the worst possible thing. So your inciting incident has actually disrupted all the expectations that you've carefully set up in your first 10 minutes. And by disrupting those expectations, you're creating a goal for your characters that's going to last for the rest of the movie, right? Because now the toys have to get out of the garbage bag and find a new home. And now Woody has to make sure he's in the college box when Andy finally leaves for college. So essentially, you're creating your story with those expectations getting disrupted. So the mistake we made in the introduction was that our characters' expectations for the future were uncertain. They were hazy, they were subject to debate, and they were vague. So the lesson learned is that when you introduce your character for the first time, you need to give your character a clear and specific set of expectations. Okay, so I'm going to show you a finished version of the scene that we just saw. And it's Woody giving the toys a pep talk and saying, guys, we're going in attic mode, but watch how much detail we tried to cram in there in terms of what life was going to be like in the attic so that you create this sort of clear visual set of expectations for the future. So here's the final version of the opening of Toy Story 3.
But through every yard sale, every spring cleaning, Andy held on to us. He must care about us or we wouldn't be here. You wait. Andy's gonna tuck us in the attic. It'll be safe and warm.
And we'll all be together.
Exactly! There's games up there and books and...
The race car track.
The race car track, thank you.
And the old TV.
There you go, the old TV. And those guys from the Christmas decorations box, they're fun, right? And someday, if we're lucky, Andy may have kids of his own.
And he'll play with us then, right?
We'll always be there for him.
Come on, guys. Let's get our parts together, get ready, and go out on a high note.
So there you go. You're just setting up that the toys think that they're all going into the attic, right? And they're not happy about it, right? Your character doesn't have to be looking forward to the future, but we have to understand when we meet them exactly what they think their future is going to be, because your story is about to disrupt that future. So the lesson learned is that when you introduce your characters, their expectations for the future have to be certain, they have to be clear, and they have to be specific. And then those expectations will be disrupted by the next tentpole moment, which is the inciting incident. Okay, so again, when I started writing Toy Story 3, I thought I knew what a good inciting incident was. Like, an inciting incident should disrupt your character's plans for the future, but it should also change their sense of self, and it should change their sense of the world. So, for example, with Little Miss Sunshine, the inciting incident is a phone call from Aunt Cindy. And for Olive, that's like the best possible thing for her. And it changes her plans for the future. It changes her sense of the world. And it changes her sense of herself. In Tootsie, for example, Dustin Hoffman, he just wants to be a working actor, right? He doesn't want to be a star. He doesn't want to be rich and famous. He just wants to find work as an actor. So logically, the inciting incident, the worst possible thing, is his agent saying,
"Nobody will hire you."
And that inciting incident, "No one will hire you," forces him to put on a dress and a wig to get acting work. And then he meets the girl of his dreams, and you're off into your second act. Okay, so what we needed in the inciting incident of Toy Story 3 was something had to happen that would motivate the toys to abandon Annie's room and donate themselves to daycare, right? And the problem, of course, is that you've had two films that establish that Annie's room is their home, you know? And now the toys have to decide that they're done with Annie's room and they're going to donate themselves to daycare. And you need to have the audience sympathetic to and even rooting for the toys to make that decision. And, like, I can't tell you, my God, like, this was something that just tormented me for, like, a year and a half, was trying to figure out how to get this goddamn story set in motion in the right way. So we tried our hardest, and we did our best, and we really put everything we thought we needed to kick off the story with a really strong and compelling inciting incident. So brace yourself. Here's our first attempt at the inciting incident of Toy Story 3.
Come on, you need to start making decisions.
Like what?
Like, what about these? Stays or goes?
I can't decide now.
Andy, like, you're really gonna take your toys with you to college?
Wait a minute. I'm gonna take Woody.
Now we're getting somewhere.
College. Definitely college.
So, what about these other toys? Should we donate them?
No.
Maybe sell them on eBay?
Mom, no one's gonna want those old toys. They're junk.
Look, you have till Saturday to decide what to do with them.
Hey! Oh, nothing, just packing up my room. Tonight?
Did anyone hear what I think I heard?
Junk! He called us junk!
What did he mean? Are we getting thrown out?
Hey, come on. No one's getting thrown out.
But why did he say that, Woody?
Well, he didn't mean it.
Sure sounded like he did.
If Andy's not taking Buzz to college, he sure ain't taking me.
Or me.
Or any of us.
Oh, I'm getting nauseous.
Whoa. This is no time to panic.
This is the perfect time to panic.
Should I be panicking?
No. Look, everyone. Look, I know Andy doesn't play with us as much as he used to. Okay, ever. But still, he cares about us. I know he does.
Easy for you to say, college boy.
Yeah, what about the rest of us?
Oh, we'll never get played with again.
Guys, come on. Have a little faith.
Woody, we always knew this day would come.
And now it's here.
The end of the line.
Hello, Sturridge.
Guys, you just can't give up on Andy. Not now. Right, Buzz? Buzz?
Where are you going?
What's he doing?
Okay, so there you go. So we bring the reels in to the main theater and we screen it for the Brain Trust and we go into the story meeting and the verdict from Andrew Stanton is Woody sounds whiny and Buzz is being a jerk. Okay, so why does this not work? What is wrong with the scene? What is missing? And here's the thing is that the scene is doing what I thought a good inciting incident should do, right? Because the toys were all hoping to go to college with Andy and instead Andy calls the toys junk and he decides to put them up in the attic. So that's disrupting their expectations for the future, right? It's changing their sense of the world. It's changing their sense of their relationship with Andy. But that's not enough to motivate the first act break, which is the toys deciding to donate themselves to daycare, right? So the question is, like, what else do you need? Like, what has to happen for your inciting incident to really work? And I can't tell you, like, how agonizing this was. Like, we kept doing different versions of the same scene over and over again, and none of them worked. And I was just, like, beating my head against the floor and not getting anywhere. So what I finally decided to do was to go back and look at the inciting incidents of the first two Toy Story movies. So you go to Toy Story, and what's the inciting incident? It's Woody gets replaced by Buzz. And it's just a great inciting incident, right? Because it's unforeseen. It's visceral because Woody gets knocked off his special spot on the bed. Remember, and he falls behind the bed. But there's also this action set piece in the middle of the first act, which is the toy soldiers go on a mission and they spy on Andy's birthday party. And that action set piece is an enactment of your character's worst fear. Because remember, at the beginning of the movie, they're all worried about being replaced. And so the inciting incident is Buzz shows up and he actually replaces Woody. And that's Woody's darkest fear coming true. It's the worst possible thing for Woody because suddenly he's no longer Andy's favorite toy. So in Toy Story 2, the inciting incident is Woody's arm gets ripped, right? And if you look at Woody's expectations for the future, right, you spend 5 minutes of the movie talking about, like, Woody's going to go to cowboy camp, he's going to cowboy camp, he's going to cowboy camp with Andy, and then, ba-boom, his arm gets ripped, and suddenly he's not going to cowboy camp with Andy. So his plans for the future are being disrupted, and he gets put up on the shelf. And it's this great inciting incident, right, because it's unforeseen, it's visceral, because he gets put on the shelf, and he has this crazy nightmare about getting thrown away. But there's also this action set piece in the middle of the first act where Woody goes out and he rescues Wheezy from the garage sale. And you've established that Woody's afraid of getting worn out and becoming obsolete. He's afraid of getting yard sailed. So the action set piece, Woody going out and rescuing Wheezy, is actually an enactment of his own worst fears. By proxy, he's rescuing himself. So, being the genius that I am, I thought, you know what? For Toy Story 3, the inciting incident should be unforeseen. It should be visceral. There should be an action set piece that is an enactment of your character's worst fears, and it should be the worst possible thing come true. And this is where, you know, when you get lost as a writer, you have to always just go back to the idea that there should be a clear and character-based logic to any good narrative. So you begin with Andy going away to college, right? So what should the toys be most afraid of? Just logically, they're afraid of getting thrown away. So then what should happen? Like, what should the inciting incident be? Again, it just seems incredibly obvious in retrospect. And I remember we had been going in circles for like months and months and the story just like wasn't working. And we had the story meeting with Andrew Stanton and I remember him saying like, just keep going. Like, I think you guys are going to find it. And I just said, no, forget it. Forget everything we've done so far. What if the toys are all in a trash bag and they're on the curb and a trash truck is coming? And Andrew said, like, if you can make me buy that image, if you can find a logical way to make that happen, then I'm on board with anything that the toys do after that. And this was the number one lesson I learned while writing Toy Story 3, is that sometimes you need to plot backwards. Sometimes you just need to figure out what has to happen to your characters and you just make it happen. And then you reverse engineer the story logic to get your characters to that point. But if you're trying to plot forward all the time, you can get lost very, very easily because if your characters are always in the driver's seat and they're always trying to figure out the best path forward, then your story will never have any real juice because your characters will never willingly submit to the worst possible thing. So for a good inciting incident, a lot of times you have to just figure out what the worst possible thing is for your characters, and then you just make that happen to them. And that way, plot is actually an expression of character, right? Because the inciting incident is just like this eruption of your hero's deepest, darkest fears or insecurities. So Hamlet's father's ghost is like this eruption of Hamlet's darkest fears about Denmark, or the witches are this eruption of Macbeth's darkest ambitions. So if the toy's deepest, darkest fear is that Andy doesn't care about them anymore, and that he's just going to throw them away, then that's exactly what has to happen in the inciting incident. So here it is, the inciting incident of Toy Story 3.
What's happening?
We're getting thrown out, you idiot. That's what's happening.
You need a hand?
I got it.
Here. So you're gonna miss me when I'm gone?
If I say no, do I still get your room?
Nope.
Then, yes, I'll miss you.
I can't breathe!
Oh, this can't be happening!
Quiet! What's that sound?
Andy!
That's not trash!
We're on the curb!
Oh, I know it would come to this.
So there it is. And, like, nobody cares about a good inciting incident. Like, no one's going to pat you on the back and go, hey, great inciting incident. But this is the part of the script that I'm actually the most proud of, because it's the thing that sets the whole story in motion and just gets your audience on board with them. So the inciting incident of Toy Story 3, right, it's unforeseen, right, because Woody says no one's getting thrown out, and then, of course, they all get thrown out. It's also visceral, right, because you have the toys, they're in a trash bag, and, oh, my God, the trash truck is coming. There's an action set piece built around the character's, like, worst fears coming true, and you just have the worst possible thing happen to the toys, which is that Andy seemingly just throws them out. And that's breaking the handshake deal that the toys thought they had with Andy, right? So it allows them to go, well, we're not wanted here anymore. It's time to find a new home.
And don't you know this box is being donated?
It's under control, Woody. We have a plan.
We're going to daycare!
Daycare? What, have you all lost your marbles?
Well, didn't you see? Andy threw us away.
No. He was putting you in the attic.
Attic? So how do we end up on the curb?
That was a mistake. Andy's mom thought you were trash.
Yeah, after he put us in a trash bag.
And called us junk!
But you also have Woody get put in the college box. And for Woody, that's like the best possible thing that could happen, right? Because now he's going to college with Andy. So the inciting incident in Toy Story 3 actually splits the story in two and sets two different story threads into motion, right? You give the toys a clear and sympathetic goal, which is to find a new home because they think that Andy doesn't care about them anymore. But you also give Woody a clear and sympathetic goal, which is he wants to go to college with Andy. So the lesson learned is that your inciting incident should be visceral, and if you want, you can build an action set piece around it. And oftentimes, it's either the best possible thing or the worst possible thing. But the biggest lesson for me was that sometimes you can't plot forward. Sometimes, if you're trying to make the best possible thing or the worst possible thing in your inciting incident or your second act break or your climax or wherever, you just have to make that thing happen and then plot backwards, reverse engineer your story so that it makes narrative and emotional sense. And the bigger your inciting incident is, the more emotional rocket fuel you're going to have when you get to the first act break. I think, you know, besides your ending, I think there's nothing more important to a good story than a clear and compelling first act break. Like, the stronger you make your first act break, the stronger the rest of your movie is going to be. So when I started Toy Story 3, like, I thought I knew what a good first act break was. Like, usually it's a two-step process. Your character's circumstances change, and then you establish a goal, and the characters begin a journey toward that goal. So in The Wizard of Oz, for example, Dorothy arrives in Oz, and she has a long-term goal, right? She wants to get home to Kansas. And then you give her a short-term plan to achieve that goal, which is to go see the wizard by following the yellow brick road. So again, for Toy Story 3, the story has been split into two. The toys have been put in a trash bag, and Woody's been put in the college box. So now the toys have a clear long-term goal, which is to find a new home, and they have a short-term plan to achieve that goal, which is to donate themselves to daycare. But for Woody, it's a more difficult question. Like, what is the journey that Woody is embarking on? What is his goal? What is his short-term plan? Now, ideally, your first act break should be a springboard into your second act, right? You want to change the direction of your story, and you want to launch your character off in this new direction with maximum rooting interest. So again, I thought I knew what a good first act break was, and we worked really, really hard to make this the strongest possible turn in the direction of Woody's story. So here it is, the first act break of the first set of reels of Toy Story 3.
And, Barbie.
Hi, Ken.
Seems you're being transferred to the butterfly classroom.
Ooh, pretty. Where's the butterfly room?
It's across the yard. I'll take you there.
But...
You hear that?
We're gonna be playing with!
But Ken, what about the kids? Aren't they coming to play with us?
Don't worry, there'll be kids in the butterfly room, too.
They're here! They're finally here! Ah, I'm gonna be playing with!
Rex?
New toys!
So there's a lot of stuff here that actually made it into the final film. But in this early version of the story, Woody has stayed at Sunnyside. So we finish the reels, we bring them into the main screening room, we show them to the Brain Trust, and we have a story meeting. And the verdict is, it's a disaster. And it's a disaster for a bunch of reasons, but the main reason is that Woody is now trapped. Like, he's been outboxed by Lotso, and now he's stuck at Sunnyside. And this creates a huge problem in the story because now Woody is a passive character. He's basically luggage in his own story, and the story is now being driven by your bad guy, Lotso. So we had made the classic screenwriting blunder of thinking that it was enough just to have a change of scenery, and that's your first act break. So, for example, Alice falls down the rabbit hole, and you think, okay, that's it, first act break. Or Dorothy arrives in Oz, and you think, oh, that's it, first act break. But it's not really, because when Dorothy arrives in Oz, right, she meets the Munchkins, she meets the antagonist, the Wicked Witch of the West, but she's still, at that point, a passive protagonist. Like, she has a goal, a long-term goal, she wants to get home to Kansas, but she has no plan at that point for achieving that goal. And it's only when someone says to her, you know, if you want to go home to Kansas, you got to go see the wizard. Now she has a short-term plan to achieve that goal, which is to go see the wizard by following the yellow brick road. And that is what turns her into an active character, and that's your real first act break. So with Toy Story 3, the original first act break was that Woody just gets trapped at Sunnyside, and then the story's midpoint initially was that Woody escapes and he heads off back to Andy's house, but that just created this huge story problem and all these ancillary problems. And we just went in circles for about a year, like trying to make that version of the story work. And the solution, which of course just seems completely obvious in retrospect, is to make Woody active right away. Like, he's been chosen to go to college with Andy, and he has to finally say, like, I can't just stay here with my friends. I've got to embark on my own journey. I've got to get home before Andy leaves for college. So you're making your hero active. Like, Woody chooses to abandon his friends and leave Sunnyside before he or anyone realizes that it's actually this terrible place. So without further ado, here's the first act break for Woody's story in the final film.
Woody, stay with us.
Come on, Woodster.
We'll get played with.
Stay here.
No,
you
no.
Can make a new
guys,
kid
really.
Happy.
No. I have a kid. You have a kid. Andy. And if he wants us at college or in the attic, well, then our job is to be there for him. Now, I'm going home. And anyone who wants to join me is welcome. Come on, Buzz. Buzz?
Our mission with Andy's complete, Woody.
What?
And what's important now is we stay together.
We wouldn't even be together if it weren't for Andy. Look under your boot, Buzz. You too, Jesse. Whose name is written there?
Maybe Andy doesn't care about us anymore.
Of course he does. He cares about all of you. He was putting you in the attic. I saw you. Can't just turn your back on him now.
Woody, wake up. It's over. Andy is all grown up.
Okay, fine. Perfect. I can't believe how selfish you all are.
So this is it? After all we've been through.
So the hero starts off on his journey, right? He's going home. So the lesson learned here is that for your first act break, it's not just enough to have circumstances change. Like, your hero has to embark on a quest. And it doesn't just have to be an external quest, like it can also be an internal quest, but your character has to be active. They have to want something desperately and then set off to fulfill that want. So your first act break has to do two things simultaneously. It has to set up both your hero's long-term goal and it has to set up your hero's short-term plan to achieve that goal. And then your second act is just a series of complications or setbacks as your hero climbs a clearly defined ladder towards their global goal. And the more compelling and sympathetic you can make that global goal, the more audience rooting interest you're going to have throughout the rest of your story. So for Toy Story 3, the global goal for Woody is always to be there for Andy. Like, that's what Woody has said for the last two films, right? Our job is not to get played with. Our job is to be there for Andy. But you also need to give your character a clear, specific, short-term plan to achieve that long-term goal. And it can't be something fuzzy like, I want to make the world a better place, right? You need a hard target. The short-term plan has got to be a clear, binary, black and white, pass-fail objective. Like, your hero is either going to achieve it or she's going to fall short. And also, there's got to be visceral positive consequences to success, and there's got to be visceral negative consequences to failure. So the second act goal for Woody is to leave his friends at Sunnyside and get home to Andy before Andy leaves for college. And you'll notice the second act goal doesn't have to be a huge thing, right? A lot of times your second act goal seems like it should be relatively easy to achieve. So in Star Wars, for example, Luke isn't heading off to defeat the whole Empire, right? He's just trying to deliver R2-D2 to Alderaan. And in Tootsie, for example, Dustin Hoffman doesn't want to be rich and famous.
Okay, I'm going to raise the $8,000 myself so I can produce his play.
He just wants to raise $8,000 so he can put on Jeff's play at the Syracuse Playhouse. So all these second act goals seem simple and relatively easy to achieve. Also, a lot of times there's a ticking clock involved. So in Little Miss Sunshine, the global goal is to win the Little Miss Sunshine pageant. And the second act goal is to get to Redondo Beach and register Olive for the pageant by 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Okay, so the lesson learned for the first act break is that your hero can't be trapped or passive as the second act begins. You want to give your character a long-term goal that is compelling, sympathetic, that engenders a maximum rooting interest for success and has visceral negative consequences for failure. And you want to give your character a short-term plan to achieve that goal, which is clear, binary, pass-fail, and oftentimes seemingly humble or easy to achieve, and sometimes with a ticking clock attached. And then, of course, your second act goal often is thwarted or changed at the midpoint, which leads us to our next tentpole moment. So when I started writing Toy Story 3, of course, I thought I knew what a decent midpoint was. Like, usually at the midpoint, you change the direction of your story, you deepen the stakes of your story, and you lay out all the exposition of your story. And a lot of times what you're also doing is creating a crisis that forces your hero to look within and to recognize an inner flaw that they were previously blind to. Okay, so the clip I'm going to show you is not from the first draft. This clip is actually pretty close to the final version of the midpoint. And we had already been through 4 or 5 sets of reels, and the midpoint was almost working, but not quite. So here it is, our 4th or 5th attempt at the midpoint of Toy Story 3.
Okay, Andy's looking in the attic. Wait, there's Mom. Why is he so upset? Oh, no. Oh, this is terrible. He's looking for us. Andy's looking for us.
He's looking for us?
Oh, Andy does want us. I knew it. I just knew it.
I think he did mean to put us in the attic.
Well, then Woody was telling the truth.
Holy cow.
And you didn't believe him.
Hey, you didn't believe him either.
Guys, we gotta go back.
But he's leaving for college.
In 2 days.
We gotta tell Buzz. Where the heck is he?
Unhand me, you cowards! I demand to talk to Lotso!
Zip it, Buck Rogers. You don't talk to Lotso till we say you can talk to...
Ken? What's going on here?
Okay, so that was the midpoint after about 2 years of working on the script. So we bring it in the main theater, we screen it for everybody, and the verdict from the Brain Trust was that it just wasn't working. And I remember Andrew Stanton saying, like, your midpoint feels like it comes 5 minutes too late. And also Gary Rystrom said, like, it feels like you're treading water in the middle of your movie. And this is one of those exasperating times where you get these vague notes, you know, and your first impulse, of course, is you just want to lunge across the room and, like, strangle somebody. But if I have one talent as a writer, it's my ability to restrain myself from lunging across the room and strangling people. So this is a good example of a situation where even if you don't know what the hell people are talking about, you still have to listen to them and try to find the note behind the note. So in the clip we just played, you have Jesse saying, "Fellas, we gotta go home," which means you have a new story direction, right? But the very next thing she says is, "Where the heck is Buzz?" And I thought that was a pretty good transition where Jesse goes, "Where the heck is he?" And you cut and you find that Buzz is tied up in a closet. Like, I was kind of proud of that little clever transition that I did. But the reason that transition doesn't work is that it makes Jessie helpless. It makes her passive. It makes her luggage in her own story. Like, they've sent Buzz off for help and he hasn't come back. And now she's just stuck in the caterpillar room with the other toys. She's got a new story goal, right? We've got to get home to Andy, but she's stuck waiting for Buzz and your story is now just treading water. Okay, so we get these notes that our story is treading water, and after floundering around for a couple of weeks, we finally realized we just had to shift the chronology of the scenes so that as soon as Jesse said, "Fellas, we gotta go home," something different happened. So I'll just play the final version of the movie, and you'll see what's different. So here it is, the final version of the midpoint of Toy Story 3.
He's looking in the attic. Wait, there's Mom. Why is he so upset? Oh, no. Oh, this is terrible. He's looking for us. Andy's looking for us.
He's looking for us?
Oh, Andy does want us. I knew it. I just knew it.
I think he did mean to put us in the attic.
Well, then Woody was telling the truth.
Holy cow.
And you didn't believe him.
Hey, you didn't believe him first.
Guys, we gotta go home. Lotso!
Hey there. How y'all doing this fine evening?
Oh, thank goodness! Have you seen Buzz?
It's been a mistake. We have to go.
Go? Why, you just got here. In the nick of time, too. We were running low on volunteers for the little ones. They just love new toys now, don't they?
Love? We've been chewed, kicked, drooled on.
Just look at my pocketbook.
Hmm. Well, here's the thing, sweet potato. You ain't leaving Sunnyside.
Sweet potato? Who do you think you're talking to? I have over 30 accessories, and I deserve more respect.
Ah, that's better.
Hey, no one takes my wife's mouth except me. Give it back, you furry air freshener.
Come on, guys. We're going home.
Whoa there, Missy. You're not going anywhere.
Oh, yeah? And who's going to stop us?
So there it is. Ba-boom. Buzz is going to stop them. So the difference is previously you had a change in the direction of your story, right? Jesse says, we got to go home. But then she just says, where the heck is Buzz? And your story is left treading water. Now, in this new version, when Jesse says, we got to go home, ba-boom, the instant she says that, the door opens and Lotso walks in and says, you're not going anywhere, Missy. So the lesson learned is that as soon as you have a new story direction, guys, we got to go home, you immediately need a new obstacle that your character has to overcome. So with Toy Story 3, I want to point out there's not just one midpoint in the movie. There's actually six different story threads, which means you have six different midpoints. So first of all, you have Andy's story, right? And Andy starts out, and it seems like he doesn't really care about the toys, right? He puts Woody in the college box, but otherwise he calls the toys junk. And it seems like he just doesn't care about them anymore. And then the other story thread is that you have the toys. Like the toys feel like, oh my God, Andy doesn't care about us anymore. So they decide, well, screw Andy. We're going to donate ourselves to Sunnyside Daycare. Then you have Lotso's story. You go to Sunnyside, you meet Lotso, and oh my God, like Lotso's like the friendliest, warmest, most welcoming guy in the world. You also have Buzz's story, like Buzz's leader of the group. Like he's the most capable toy, and he's the only one who can get through the transom. So now Buzz is going off to find Lotso and get them all moved out of the caterpillar room and into the butterfly room. Then you also have the Ken and Barbie story. They fall madly in love right away, and they take off in this state of romantic bliss. And then you have the Sunnyside story thread, which initially it seems like it's the nicest place in the world. Like it's the perfect haven for outgrown toys. Plus, you also have Woody on his own separate story thread because he's left Sunnyside and he's on a mission now to get back to Andy's house before Andy leaves for college. So what happens at the beginning of this scene is that Mrs. Potato Head looks through her lost eye and you reveal that Andy does want the toys. Like Andy was acting all cool when his mom was around, but really he did mean to put the toys in the attic and he really does care about them. So that's a reversal in the Andy story. Then 10 seconds after that, you change the toy story because they say, oh my God, like if Andy still cares about us, that means we have to go home. So you change the direction in the toy story. So 10 seconds after that, you have Lotso walk in the door. And now he's not such a friendly, welcoming guy anymore. He says, you guys aren't going anywhere. And you reveal that Lotso is actually a bad guy. And then 10 seconds after that, you have Buzz show up. And Buzz is no longer a helpful ally. He has actually become an obstacle. He's now a deluded prison guard who is preventing the toys from leaving. And then 10 seconds after that, you have Barbie show up. And she says, Ken, what's going on here? And suddenly they're no longer madly in love. And she breaks up with him. And 10 seconds after that, you show that all the toys get herded up and put into cubbies. And you reveal that Sunnyside isn't such a warm and welcoming place. After all, Sunnyside is actually a prison. And then all those reversals happen in one scene in less than 3 minutes. And I'm sorry, but that's just a good midpoint for the whole movie. And in the very next scene, you cut to Woody and he Googles the address to Andy's house and he realizes, oh my God, like I'm right around the corner. Like he's just a few blocks away from achieving his second act goal of getting back to Andy's house before Andy leaves for college. But then Woody hears a story from Chuckles the Clown about how Lotso took over Sunnyside and turned it into a place of ruin and despair. So now there's a midpoint reversal in Woody's story too, because now Woody has to go back to Sunnyside and rescue all his friends. And this is why, as a writer, it's sometimes helpful to look at your story from 30,000 feet, because when the Brain Trust said your midpoint feels like it's coming 5 minutes too late, they were exactly right. What happened in the old version of the scene was that we did the midpoint reversal in the Andy story, like Andy still cares about his toys, and then a midpoint reversal in the Toy story. But then we had a problem because we had 5 minutes elapse before we did a reversal in the Lotso story, the Buzz story, the Ken and Barbie story, the Sunnyside story, and the Woody story. And that 5 minute lapse meant that there was a lull and the story was just treading water. So as a writer, if you just go up to 30,000 feet and you x-ray your story in formal terms, you'll see there are six different story threads and there are six different story reversals happening. And you'll just logically see that they should all happen at the same time in the same scene. That's just good storytelling. So a story note that can sound incredibly vague, like your midpoint comes 5 minutes too late, is actually describing a structural problem very accurately. Some of your midpoints are separated from each other by 5 minutes. So for a midpoint, the lesson learned is that every time you have a new direction in your story, that requires a new story obstacle. And your reversals, if you have multiple story threads, should happen in as close proximity to each other as possible. But the main thing is that you don't want your characters treading water, right? If they have a goal, they need to embark on a plan to achieve that goal right away, or they need to immediately encounter some sort of obstacle to achieving that goal. And they'll either succeed in their second act plan, or they'll fail in that plan when they get to the second act break. Okay, so when I started writing Toy Story 3, I thought I knew what a decent second act break was. Generally, it's the moment where you force the stakes of your story. So with Toy Story 3, the toys get to Sunnyside Daycare, and it turns out to be a prison. So their midpoint goal is, we got to get out of here, we got to get back to Andy. So then the whole third quarter of the film is just a big set piece where they execute this elaborate escape from Sunnyside, and they get up to the cusp of freedom, and then they get busted by Lotso, and now it looks like they're going to be prisoners again. Okay, so what I'm going to show you now is from the earliest set of reels, before they were even complete. Sometimes, very early on, Pixar does what they call a storybook version of the reels, where there's no recorded dialogue, you just do sketches of the movie, and then you have a narrator coming in and telling you what happens. So this is just super primitive, super early storytelling, but again, we were following the template of what I thought a good second act break should be. So here it is, the earliest version of the second act break of Toy Story 3.
At the bottom of the dark and slimy chute, they find themselves in a high-walled chamber, open to the stars above. Freedom! Rex accidentally trips an electric eye. A loud motor starts, and the floor of the chamber begins sliding open, revealing a dark pit of crushed garbage below. The floor slowly disappears into the wall until just a narrow ledge remains. Then abruptly, the motor stops. They hear the sound of clapping and look up to see Lotso and his gang perched above them, waiting. They've been caught. Lotso belittles the toys.
What are you doing, running back to your kid? He don't love you. You think you're special? You're a piece of plastic. You were made to be thrown away.
In Lotso's warped worldview, kids use toys and toys use kids. Woody counters with an impassioned speech that defends the bond between toy and owner. The daycare toys are seduced. When Lotso sees the effect Woody's words are having on his own gang, he makes fun of them.
There is no love. Never was.
Well, what about Daisy?
Lotso flinches. Woody reveals the close bond that once existed between Lotso and Daisy. Lotso vilifies Daisy, but his harsh words confuse Big Baby. Woody produces a small locket given to him by Chuckles the Clown back at Bonnie's house. He tosses it to Lotso, who laughs and crushes it under his foot. A tear drips down from Big Baby's eye. He cries,
"Mama!"
Then picks up a struggling Lotso and throws him into the garbage pit. He's gone. Everyone cheers. Things are going to be different at Sunnyside from now on.
How can we repay you?
By treating toys fairly. Equal work for equal play. We're all in this together, right?
As the toys celebrate, a filthy Lotso suddenly pulls a pin from a safety chain, and Andy's toys tumble into the pit with him. Just then, they hear the sound of an approaching garbage truck. The dumpster is suddenly lifted and emptied into the back of the garbage truck. As the truck drives away, the toys struggle to find each other in the dark, smelly interior. The truck pulls into the county dump.
So we bring this in, we screen it for the Brain Trust, and the verdict is, Andrew Stanton says, I don't buy it. Like, I don't buy Woody giving this heroic speech and having all the daycare toys suddenly realize, oh, wait a minute, like, Lotso's a bad guy. Like Andrew said, look, the toys at Sunnyside are not stupid. They already know that Lotso's a bad guy. They don't need Woody to give them a big speech to turn the tide against him. So the whole thing doesn't ring true, and it's just not satisfying. So the question becomes, like, what are we missing? Like, what is going wrong here? So again, sometimes it's helpful just to go back up to 30,000 feet and analyze your story in purely formal terms. You go, okay, what usually happens in the second act break of a story? Like, usually you're creating a crisis in all three sets of stakes of your story. So in Toy Story 3, the external stakes are the toys' future. Like, are they going to end up in a nice, safe home, or are they going to end up at the dump? Then the internal stakes are all about Andy, right? Does Andy still care about the toys or not? And what's philosophically at stake in the story is, like, is the love between a child and a toy real? Like, is it something that is real and lasting, or is it just fleeting and illusory? So if you look at this version of the second act break externally, all the toys have been taken off of the dump, and that's a huge setback in the external stakes of the story, right? There's also a huge setback in the internal stakes, right? Because it seems like the toys won't see Andy again, and they'll never have a chance to reciprocate or receive his love, right? However, in this version of the story, like, Woody wins his argument against Lotso because he convinces everybody that love between a child and a toy is real. And now, obviously, one of these things is not like the other, right? You're losing in your external stakes. You're losing in your internal stakes, but for some reason, because it's badly written, your hero is winning the argument against your villain. So that's the problem, right? Your hero is succeeding in the philosophical stakes of the story. So obviously, the solution is your hero, Woody, has to now lose the argument to Lotso. Because look, if Woody wins the argument with Lotso, then that means that Woody is always right, which means the philosophical stakes of your story are never in doubt, which means your story never challenges your audience, and your story is boring. However, if Woody loses the argument with Lotso, that means that Woody's uncertain, he's confused, it means that he has depth and complexity as a hero, it means that the philosophical stakes of the story are in doubt, and it means that your story is challenging your audience, and hopefully your story is not boring. So at the end of the second act, your hero is going to fail externally, he's going to fail internally, and he's also going to fail philosophically. Woody has to lose the argument to Lotso. So here it is, the finished second act break of Toy Story 3.
I'm sorry, cowboy. They broke me.
What are y'all doing? Running back to your kid? He don't want you no more.
That's a lie.
Is it? Tell me this, Sheriff. If your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? You think you're special, cowboy? You're a piece of plastic. You were made to be thrown away. Speak of the devil. Now, we need toys in our caterpillar room, and you need to avoid that truck. Why don't you come on back? Join our family again.
This isn't a family. It's a prison. You're a liar and a bully, and I'd rather rot in this dumpster than join any family of yours.
Jesse's right. Authority should derive from the consent of the governed, not from the threat of force.
If that's what you want.
So what you're doing here, right, is having Woody lose the argument to Lotso. And you have Jesse say, you know, this place is a prison and you're a coward and a bully and you give Barbie the zinger about the consent of the governed. But Woody has always felt this huge attachment to Andy, right? This duty to always be there for him. And now Andy is leaving and going off to college. And Lotso says, if your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? And Woody doesn't have an answer. And I remember there was a moment sort of halfway through the process. We've been working on the script for about a year and a half. And in the middle of a story meeting, Andrew Stanton suddenly just says, like, wait a minute. Like, what is Lotso doing in our movie? Like, it's not just enough to make him a bad guy. Like, why is he here? Like, what is he contributing to the story? So then, great. Like, now we have to sit down and spend like a year, like, trying to figure out, like, who Lotso is. So a lot of times, right, your bad guy is like the dark doppelganger of your hero. Like, your villain is there to illuminate the deepest fears and insecurities of your hero. So logically, Lotso should represent a sort of repressed dark side of Woody's character. So then the question becomes, obviously, like, what is Woody's dark side? What is Woody's greatest fear? And one of the best bits of story advice I ever heard was at one point, Andrew said, like, if there's an ugly truth in your story, you cannot avoid it. Like, if you try to avoid it, your audience is going to sense that you're just bullshitting them, right? If there's an ugly truth in your story, you need to turn the steering wheel and drive straight at it. And the ugly truth about toys is that they're essentially disposable. Like, nobody keeps their toys forever, right? Everyone outgrows their toys and eventually leaves them behind, right? And I remember Andrew saying, like, that is the ugly truth at the center of this movie, and we can't hide from it. So what we came up with was the idea that philosophically, Lotso's view is that toys are inherently tragic figures, right? Because toys naturally fall in love with children, and children always grow up, and they always leave their toys behind. So Lotso believes that any toy that falls in love with a child is just a sucker, right? Because they're always going to get betrayed in the end. So Lotso just doesn't think that the love between a child and a toy is real, right? Because toys always get left behind. And when he says to Woody, like, if your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? He's poking at this nagging doubt that Woody has in the back of his mind that maybe Andy is leaving the toys because he doesn't really care about them anymore. And you have to remember that Woody has gone through 2.5 movies saying that the job of a toy is to be there for Andy. Like, in his mind, love means always being there. But now, like, Andy's going off to college, and Lotso is asking a question that goes right to the darkest heart of Woody's fears, and Woody doesn't have an answer. So for your second act break, you're creating a crisis in the external stakes of your story and in the internal stakes of your story, but you're also creating a crisis in the philosophical stakes of your story, and there should be no way out of that crisis. So your bad guy is going to poke at your hero and taunt him and provoke his deepest fears and insecurities, and your hero doesn't have an answer.
Where's your kid now, Sheriff?
You want it to seem like your hero has failed, not just externally and internally, but philosophically too. So, for example, like at the end of the second act of It's a Wonderful Life, right, Mr. Potter says to George Bailey, well, George Bailey,
miserable little clerk crawling in here on your hands and knees and begging for help. No securities, no stocks, no bonds, nothing but a miserable little $500 equity and a life insurance policy. You're worth more dead than alive.
You're worth more dead than alive, right? And George Bailey goes, oh my God, he's right. Like I'm just going to go kill myself now because at least, you know, Donna Reed and my kids are going to have money from my insurance policy. And I just think that Mr. Potter is one of the great screen villains of all time because his worldview is so clear and convincing that it just feels irrefutable, right? Like, he's the richest man in town, and everybody knows it.
What about all your other friends?
They don't have that kind of money, Mr. Potter. You know that. You're the only one in town that can help me.
So when Mr. Potter says to George Bailey, like, you're worth more dead than alive, like, you in the audience, you sit there, you go, well, he's being kind of a dick about it, but he's basically right. Like, Mr. Potter's richer, George Bailey's poor, and there's just no getting around that fact. Okay, so the lesson learned is that for your second act break, you've got to create a crisis in all three sets of stakes, and you want to have your hero and the audience not be able to see any way out of those crises until you get to the story's climax. Okay, so a lot of people think that the climax of Toy Story 3 is the incinerator scene, but to be honest, that's just a standard sort of Jeopardy rescue scene. You could call it the action climax of the movie, but it actually has nothing to do with the real climax of the story. So what's the real climax of the story? So if a story has three sets of stakes, then your story has three climaxes, which are the moments in which those stakes get resolved either positively or negatively. So for Woody, the external stakes are whether he's going to stay with Andy or not, right? So the external climax is the moment when Andy hands over Woody to Bonnie and you're resolving that Woody actually won't stay with Andy. He's found a new home with Bonnie. And then the internal stakes are the question of whether Andy still cares about the toys or not. So the internal climax is the moment when Andy tells Bonnie how important the toys are to him. But most stories, you can't get to your external climax or your internal climax without first going through the philosophical climax. So the philosophical climax is the moment in which your hero changes. They become a better person or they fail to change and they remain stuck as you are. So if your hero changes for the better, then your philosophical climax is what you would call the hero's epiphany. So when I started working on Toy Story 3, I thought I knew how a good epiphany worked. Like, I like to think of it as a flipping the binoculars moment. Like, your hero has gone through the whole movie looking at the world through the wrong end of the binoculars. Like, she can see the world clearly, but she's viewing it from a skewed perspective. And when she flips the binoculars, philosophically speaking, she's looking at the exact same world, but now she's seeing it through a new lens. And then because she's had this epiphany, because she's had this sudden change in how she sees the world, that leads to success in the external stakes of the story, which then leads to success in the internal stakes of the story. So that's how it works in theory. And based on that theory, we put together the best hero's epiphany that we could come up with, and we put that into the first set of reels. And this is just the earliest version, so it's done in storybook form, so it's just pictures and narrators. So brace yourself. Here's our first shot at the hero's epiphany in Toy Story 3.
They race into the house. Upstairs, Woody and the toys share a quick but emotional goodbye. Maybe they'll see each other again someday. Woody hesitates, but when Buzz asks him what his job is, Woody answers automatically.
To make a child happy.
They both smile. The toys climb into a box labeled Attic, while Woody climbs into the college box. Sitting inside the box, Woody feels troubled and unsettled. Something's not right. Suddenly, an epiphany washes over him, and he scrambles out of his box, grabbing a Sharpie. He scribbles out the word attic on the other box and writes something we don't see.
So we bring these reels into the main theater, and we screen it. And the epiphany in the reels, which comes at the very end, is that Woody says to Buzz, like, my job as a toy is to make a child happy. But I realize now that Andy's not a child anymore, so now I can let go of Andy. And this is just a terrible epiphany to give Woody because we in the audience have seen for the whole movie, right, that Andy's not a child anymore. So it makes your hero seem stupid. It makes your story seem stupid. And most of all, it makes you, the writer, seem very, very stupid. And then the other problem with this epiphany is that it's not universal, it's not resonant. Like, we in the audience, we're not toys. Our job isn't to make a child happy. So Woody's epiphany, it doesn't really speak to us about the question of how we should live our lives. And it's just obvious that the best epiphanies in movies are the ones that are universal, the ones that everyone can relate to, the ones that have meaning to all of us. Okay, so our first shot at giving Woody an epiphany doesn't work at all, right? So then the question becomes, like, what is it? What should Woody's epiphany be? And this is where writing is just incredibly brutal because, like, no one is going to give you the answer to this. You just got to, like, just knuckle down and figure it out for yourself. So the first Toy Story movie was about Woody learning to share the spotlight with Buzz, right? And Toy Story 2 is all about Woody learning to accept his mortality. And so the problem we faced on Toy Story 3 was, like, you know, good God, like, what other life lessons are there left to learn? I mean, once you've learned to not be selfish and you've learned to, accept your own mortality, you're pretty much done, right? Like, what else is there to learn? And so the question you're trying to answer as a writer is, like, what is Woody thinking in that moment in the moving box when he just decides for himself, you know what, like, I'm not going to go to college with Andy. I'm going to stay with my friends, the other toys. Like, why does Woody make that decision? And, oh my God, like, this was just a complete fucking nightmare trying to figure this out. And, like, we floundered around and went in circles for, like, a year, like beating our head against the floor. And finally, we go like, okay, like what is the problem we're trying to solve here? And the logical answer is that your hero's epiphany has to resolve the philosophical problem that you set up back at the second act break. So you go back to the second act break with Lotso and Woody facing off at the dumpster. And Lotso says to Woody, like, if your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? And Woody doesn't have an answer. And so figuratively speaking, right, this is like Lotso taking out this rhetorical dagger and just stabbing Woody in the side with it. And Woody can't pull this thing out. Like, philosophically, it's a thorn in his side that he can't get rid of. So your epiphany is like Woody finally being able to pull this thorn out of his side. So the reason Woody doesn't have an answer to Lotso's question has to be that Woody and Lotso basically see the world in the same way. Like Woody has said from the very first movie, like, our job is not getting played with. It's about being there for Andy. And so for both Woody and Lotso, love means always being there. Like, we got to be there for Andy because we love him. He's there for us. We're there for him. But now Andy's leaving. And what does that mean? Like, does it mean that he doesn't love us anymore? Like, did he ever love us? And we've already established in the backstory that Lotso loved Daisy, right? Daisy loved Lotso. Lotso loved Daisy. They were always there for each other. But then one day, Lotso accidentally got left behind and Daisy replaced Lotso. And for Lotso, the message was that if Daisy replaced me, that means she never loved me. Because if love means always being there for someone, right, then Daisy must not have really loved me because she wasn't there for me. And then Lotso universalizes that by saying, well, like, if Daisy never loved me, then there's no real love between a child and a toy. If Woody really believes that love means always being there, then that means that Andy should always be there for the toys, right? But now Andy's going off to college and, like, how in the world are you as a writer going to wring a happy ending out of that? And this is like one of the hardest things we did on Toy Story 3. And we talked about this for like months and months and months and months. And we finally came up with something. So I'm going to show you the final version of Woody's epiphany in the finished movie. Here it is.
You know where to find us, cowboy.
Molly?
Mom, we've said goodbye like 10 times.
Oh, Andy.
Mom, it's okay.
I know. It's just... I wish I could always be with you.
You will be, Mom.
Who's a good dog? Who's a good doggy? I'm gonna miss you.
He's telling you to go already.
Come on, get the rest of your things.
Okay, Buster. Now don't let Molly near my stuff. Hey, Mom. So, you really think I should donate these?
It's up to you, honey. Whatever you want to do.
So, the epiphany in Toy Story 3 comes from Andy himself. You have Andy's mom hug him and say, I wish I could always be there for you. And it's Andy himself that gives Woody the answer by saying, you will be, Mom. And this is your flipping the binoculars moment, right? Because suddenly you're shifting the meaning of being there from a literal thing to being there in a metaphorical sense. And that's the epiphany that allows Woody to finally let go of Andy, even though he loves Andy more than anything in the world. And so now the philosophical stakes of the story are like resonant and universal. The Toy Story films have always been this allegory of parenthood, and Toy Story 3 completes that allegory because, you know, you love a child, right? You give everything you can to your child, and one day your child is going to grow up and leave home. And you're going to be left wondering, like, if your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? So Toy Story 3 is about that universal drama of parenthood. But it's even more than that, right? Because all of us go through our lives knowing people and being deeply connected to them. And then, you know, life intervenes. We have to move on with our lives. and we're not with them anymore. And we can sometimes wonder, like, well, what was that connection all about? Like, we all have, like, our best friends forever in grade school, or high school sweethearts, or professors in college, or, you know, the colleagues that we have at our first job. And you get to know these people, and you form these deep attachments to them. And then one day, life leads you to something else, and you can move on, and you go, like, how real was that relationship? And I think in our darker moments, like, we can be tempted to think that, like, it was all just transient and meaningless, that the love and the connection that we felt was actually just an illusion. I mean, if it had been real, like, wouldn't we have stayed together? Like, if we were really best friends forever, like, wouldn't we still hang out with each other every day? Like, and what does it mean now that we don't? And the answer is a universal thing, which is that you can love someone and not have to always be with them. And sometimes, and this is what Andy's mom teaches Woody, sometimes the most loving thing that you can do to someone is just to let them go. Like, even if it's going to break your heart, you have to let them go. So that's the lesson that we can all learn. And that's what makes it so emotional at the end, because it's something that we all have to deal with in our daily lives. So what did we learn during the 3 years that it took to write Toy Story 3? Like, number one thing I learned was to be humble, because when we first started out, I thought I knew what good storytelling was, and that still didn't prevent me from getting lost and going in circles for 3 years. So for the introduction, the lesson learned is that your character's expectations for the future have to be certain, they have to be clear, and they have to be specific. And the more specific and vivid and sympathetic you can make those expectations, the stronger it'll be when your inciting incident comes along and disrupts them. And for your inciting incident, the lesson learned is that it should be a bolt from the blue. It should be unforeseen. It should be visceral. And oftentimes, it's the best possible thing for your hero or the worst possible thing. And a lot of times, you can't get there by plotting forward. Like, you have to make the worst possible thing happen, and then you reverse engineer the story so that it makes narrative and emotional sense. So for the first act break, the lesson learned is that it's got to be the beginning of a quest. Like, your hero has to desperately want something, and we in the audience should be rooting for them to get what they're after. So your hero can't be passive. Like, your hero has to become active. You have to give them a sympathetic and compelling global goal, and then a specific and clearly defined plan, which is the first step to achieving that global goal. And the second act plan that your hero embarks upon has to be a clear, binary, black and white, pass-fail objective that your hero is either going to achieve or fail to achieve. And a lot of times, your second act goal is relatively humble. Like, it seems like it should be easy to achieve, and there is a ticking clock attached to it. And last but not least, you want visceral negative consequences if your hero fails to achieve that goal. Now, for the midpoint, the lesson learned was that every new direction in the story immediately requires new obstacles, and all midpoint reversals in your story should happen in as close proximity to each other as possible with no treading water. Now, for the second act break, the lesson learned is that you have to have a failure in your external set of stakes. You also have a failure in your internal set of stakes, but you also need a failure in your philosophical stakes. And then for the epiphany, the lesson learned is that many times you have a flip the binoculars moment. Like, your hero has to share your villain's point of view.
Adventure is out there!
And your villain's point of view has to seem like it's just irrefutable. Like, your villain can be a jerk, but he's also just saying, like, hey, like, this is just the way the world works, you know, grow up, you know, and your hero doesn't have an answer to refute that. And the crucial thing here is that your villain is not wrong. Like, your villain is right. The way your villain looks at the world is right, it's self-evident, it's irrefutable. But your villain is looking at the world in a shallow, petty, and literal-minded way. He's looking at the world through the wrong end of the binoculars, just like your hero. So your hero's new truth is not that the bad guy is wrong, per se. Like, your hero's epiphany gives her a new way of looking at the world that is deeper, more generous, more poetic than the villain's view of the world. So for Toy Story 3, like, Andy's mom says, "I wish I could always be there with you." And Andy himself says, "You will be, Mom," and you're flipping what it means to be there for someone. Like, in Up, for example, Carl Fredrickson goes through the whole movie, like, thinking that he's a failure, right? Because he never gave his wife, Ellie, the life of adventure that he promised her, like, when they were younger. And Carl goes through the whole movie, like, thinking, like, adventure is out there, adventure is out there. And because he never left his hometown, he thinks that he never gave Ellie a real adventure. So the epiphany at the end of Up is that Carl goes through the adventure book, and he sees all the pictures from his life in the small town with Ellie. And when he gets to the last page, he sees that Ellie has written an inscription, "Thanks for the adventure. Now go have another." And then you're flipping the meaning, because suddenly you're saying the greatest adventure is not out there. The greatest adventure is being in love and sharing your life with someone. In It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey goes through the whole movie feeling like he's a failure. Like, he thinks, like, I never moved out of this town. Like, I just worked on my dad's little savings and loan. And, like, maybe I helped a few people, but I'm not a rich man. like Mr. Potter. Like, Mr. Potter's the richest man in town, and I'm a failure, and now I'm worth more dead than alive. I'm just going to go kill myself. And at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey goes like, I want to live again, and you're overturning the internal, the emotional stakes of the story. And then he goes home, and Donna Reed goes, George, George, it's a miracle. And they've raised $8,000, and you've overturned the external stakes of the story, right? But George Bailey still thinks he's a poor man, right? He still thinks that he's a failure. He still thinks that he lived his life in the wrong way, and he has nothing to show for it. And then you have George's war hero brother fly through the blizzard and come in and raise a toast and say to George Bailey, the richest man in town, and you're flipping the meaning of what it means to be rich. And in each case, you're redefining what it means to be there for someone, what it means to have an adventure, what it means to be rich. And in each case, the definition is reaching towards a deeper, more generous, more poetic way of looking at the world. So you're redefining life in ways that are deeper, more generous, and more poetic. And that's what storytelling is. The end. So that's a lecture that I gave at Pixar back in 2011. And obviously not every story has to work this way, right? Like, you can write a story any way you want. Like, every story has its own logic, its own problems and solutions. But I'll just tell you, man, good storytelling is really, really hard. It takes a long, long time. It involves a lot of trial and error. So if you're trying to write a script and you're walking in circles and you're going down blind alleys and you're beating your head against the floor, I hope some of these ideas will be helpful. So good luck and happy writing.
Cuando salgan a volar, hay un amigo en mí. Sí, un amigo en mí. Hay un amigo en mí. Hay un amigo en mí. Hay un amigo en mí. Cuando salgan.